tonight on Lost in the Vault.
If it would please the court, my client would like to... He's guilty. To... Oh, man, what is that called?
You're guilty!
He's guilty!
Just say you're guilty!
No, no, not that. Not that. What are you... Something else.
Oh! It's, go to tree jail!
Tree jail!
Tree jail for you!
No, no, not that. Look, what do you call it when he... When he wants to get out of this?
Oh, that's the sweet release of death. Yeah, evisceration by a thousand branches of a mighty oak!
Hey, happy holidays, everybody!
Hello. Merry everything.
Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Life Day, you name it. So yes, our second episode is a holiday episode because we are terrible at scheduling.
So yeah, we started this right around when the holidays were rolling around. So we get to do this now.
Yeah.
On our second official episode.
And also, this is our first official live episode. And by that, I mean we're recording this while Amanda's roommate and her girlfriend are in the room with us. So if you hear laughing, it's because they're laughing at something that's not us.
Or I'm laughing at myself.
Yeah. That's Vaughn right now. All right. So, Amanda, tell
yes.
me. When you think of Disney and Christmas, what do you think of?
Mickey in a Christmas hat.
After that.
Goofy in a Christmas hat.
After that.
Donald in a Christmas hat. Why do you keep asking me these questions?
Every answer to your question is going to be a different Disney character in a Christmas
yes.
hat. Point is, we're talking Babes in Toyland.
We're talking
the
Babes in Toyland.
1961? Was it 1960? What? No, it was 1961.
61.
Right? Now, the 1961 holiday musical extravaganza that actually doesn't really have that much to do with Christmas.
Not at all, really. Until like the second half.
I mean, they mention it, you know, but other than that.
There's toys.
Yeah. And a toy maker.
Yeah.
And Tommy Kirk.
Tommy Kirk.
What's Christmas without Tommy Kirk? So this was Disney's first attempt at a live-action musical. You know, they'd done animated musicals before, but, you know, the live-action musical was in vogue in the 50s and 60s.
It was.
And Disney wanted in on it. But we can't start right there. We've got to start with Babes in Toyland source material. So we have to go all the way back.
1903.
To, yeah, near the beginning of the 20th century with the original operetta, which was done with a score by Victor Herbert and a libretto by Glenn McDonough, which now you might be asking yourself, what is an operetta?
What the fuck is an operetta?
That is a good question. It is very hard to define what exactly an operetta is. It's essentially the in-between of the traditional opera and the modern stage musical. So the way the songs are constructed and how they like advance the story and lack thereof are very much opera, but they also have like elements that you'd see later in musical theater, like spoken dialogue and such like that. Operettas tended to be more comic in nature than the traditional opera. In fact, the Gilbert Sullivan stuff, they can be referred to intermittent either as comic operas or as operettas.
Victor Herbert was like one of the pioneers of modern, what we understand as modern musical theater.
Yeah.
Because his operettas, this one and The Wizard of Oz, shaped what like popular stage shows looked like.
Yeah, pretty much. So Babes in Toyland, Kate, came out to the public on October 13th, 1903, premiering at the Majestic Theater at 5 Columbus Circle, which is now the site of the Time Warner building because, you know, everything's terrible and we can't have nice things in historic buildings anymore. It came out with 22 songs and four added in touring productions. Now, you may be wondering, so how can I give this original operetta a listen? Here's the thing. You can't, really.
I mean, there's no recordings of it, are there?
Well, okay. Technically, there is a recording that was done around 2001 by 2001. John McGlynn, who was a conductor and musical theater archivist responsible for the restoration and recording of old-time Broadway musicals and operettas. Stuff like Showboat, Anything Goes, Brigadoon, Annie Get Your Gun, Kiss Me Kate. In the early 2000s, he was going through the entire chronology of Victor Herbert operettas with the funding of philanthropist David Woodley Packard and his Packard Humanities Institute. And the recording was done in full, had a pretty stacked cast, including Sir Ian McKellen
as
the master toy maker, and Ian Richardson, who you might know as the main star of the original BBC series of House of Cards, as Barnaby.
Oh, wow. Did they update anything, or was it just
a full
recording?
The original show, that's what John McGlynn specialized in. Recordings of the shows in its original state, especially if, you know, a lot of stuff had been, like, cut or changed over the years. Like, Showboat is a good example of that. Now, the problem is that John McGlynn and his funder, David Woodley Packard, had a falling out. Mm-hmm. And the recording of Babes in Toyland has never been commercially released. You can find, like, bootleg recordings. In fact, I did find a whole bunch of tracks from it on YouTube. But to this day, there has never been an official release of this recording of the original operetta. In fact, no other like full recording of the entire operetta exists. There have been like releases that have like some or most of the tracks, but not all of them. So like if you want to listen to like the full operetta soundtrack on a CD, you cannot.
It's unfortunate. I have my CD player already.
Yeah. Like your only chance to get the full operetta is if you see it on stage, unless they're doing like the 1970s revised version.
How often are they doing the 1903 version, though, you know?
I honestly don't know anymore. But yeah, so the basic plot of Babes in Toyland, like, it uses a lot of like fairy tale and nursery rhyme characters.
Mother Goose stuff.
Mother Goose stuff, but Mother Goose is not in the original operetta. Yeah. So there are two main couples that the show is a focus on. There is the couple of Alan and Contrary Mary, mm-hmm. and then Alan's sister Jane and Contrary Mary's brother Tom-Tom.
Do they ever call him Tom or Tommy, or is it always Tom-Tom?
They do refer to him as Tom in the original.
Okay, that's
operetta. So
I can't imagine taking anyone seriously like that goes by Tom-Tom.
I might. Depends on the situation. So Alan and Jane are orphans of an evil miser named Barnaby who wants to get their hands on his inheritance. So what he does is that he hires two like con artists, professional criminals named
henchmen.
Sorta. Named named Gonzorgo and Rodrigo to take them aboard a boat and then have the boat sink. Mm-hmm. And then due to a clause in their inheritance, if they do not return within a week after leaving, he will get their money. So.
And he wants their money, so.
Yeah, and he also wants to marry Mary for reasons. So that's another reason to get Alan and, to a lesser extent, Jane out of the way. But, you know, Mary only has eyes for Alan. Yeah, there's a lot of, like, intersecting stuff going on. A lot of plots.
It's very complicated, it seems.
Yeah, so. But it turns out, Alan and Jane survive, and they return, and, you know, Alan wants to pursue Mary, but Mary's mother, the Widow Piper, does not like Alan, and wants her daughter Mary to marry the wicked miser Barnaby for whatever reason.
Silas Barnaby? Isn't that his full name?
I forget what his full name is, but it wouldn't surprise me if his name was Silas.
Barnaby is a very good villain.
It is a very good villain name. Anyways, so, Alan finds evidence of Barnaby trying to court her and believing that Mary's leaving him, they get into a fight and Alan and Jane decide to run away. So Barnaby comes up with another scheme to lure them into a forest of spiders so that they will get eaten by those spiders.
Yes.
But that doesn't work. And they end up...
Unfortunate for the spiders.
Yeah, unfortunate. I don't even think the spiders show up based on the script that I even read. They were like moths, dancing moths that protected them. Point being that, and they end up arriving in Toyland. And then meanwhile, Tom-Tom had earlier run away to look for Jane because he loves Jane. And Mary later runs away to get away from Barnaby. And all four of them end up in Toyland with Barnaby, the Widow Piper, and the Widow Piper's other children, you know, like Red Riding Hood and Little Bo Peep, mm-hmm. and like Jack and Jill.
Other favorite fairy tale characters.
Nursery rhyme.
Nursery rhyme.
In pursuit. They end up in Toyland. Tom-Tom and Mary get jobs as a court crier and adult dress maker. Meanwhile, Barnaby meets up with the master toy maker and offers him a huge sum of money to build toys that will kill children, that he can kill Alan and Jane.
They're in cahoots?
Well, sorta. You see, they had met prior, but it turns out that the master toy maker is evil and wants to find the method to summon the spirits of demons and evil people so that they can possess toys so that they can cause mass mayhem. That's another thing. This original operetta is oddly dark and weird. I mean, I guess it was like the early 1900s. The First World War is happening.
It was pre any World War.
Shit, did I just fuck up history?
You did just fuck up history. Congratulations.
Great. All that research for naught.
Nah, it was, that happened like 10 years later.
Okay. Well, point is, it was dark times.
It was.
So the master toy maker does find the way to summon the evil spirits, but, those toys turn on him and kill him. And Barnaby, ever the opportunist, frames Alan for the master toy maker's murder. So Alan is put on trial to be hung.
Oh my God.
And
none of this is in the Disney version.
No, yeah, we'll make it clear right now. None of this is in the Disney. Mary makes a deal with Barnaby to marry him in exchange for him letting Alan go free. But, Barnaby lies because he's Barnaby.
Yes.
So, but Tom-Tom finds a clause in Toyland's bylaws in which if Alan marries a widow, then he will be able to go free. So after a long sequence of widows sizing him up to see if they want to marry him, what happens is Gonzergo and Rodrigo, who are now working as executioners, pretend to be executioners for reasons that make sense in context, are worried they're going to botch up the job and expose themselves. They offer Alan some poisoned wine so that way, they can fake executing him properly if they don't execute him properly. But Barnaby comes in, drinks the poisoned wine, dies, which makes Mary a widow. So now she can marry Alan. And it ends. That's it.
Wow.
That's Babes in Toyland.
That's
acclaimed opera that's had six film adaptations now?
Plus some cartoon ones, I think, and So after that, there's many, many, there's lots of stage revivals, rewrites, films.
A puppet show version with Mickey Rooney.
Yeah.
But in terms of film and television adaptations, film media, the Disney one is not the first and it is far from the last. The first film adaptation was in 1934.
Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah, Laurel and Hardy in Babes in Toyland, also known as Laurel and Hardy in Toyland, Revenge is Sweet, and March of the Wooden Soldiers.
Yeah.
Produced by Hal Roach and released by MGM. Laurel and Hardy play characters that are created exclusively for the movie, Stanny Dum and Ollie D. Only 6 songs from the operetta are featured in the movie. And significant plot changes. I don't think in any of the adaptations the master toy maker is evil like he is in the original operetta.
Yeah, he's mostly just clueless or
a goof. Or a kindly old man. Or, as we'll see later on, Santa himself.
Wow.
And also, the Laurel and Hardy movie features creepy puppets of Disney's Three Little Pigs and a especially creepy appearance by Mickey Mouse, done by dressing a monkey in a Mickey Mouse costume.
Yeah.
Officially licensed appearances, from Disney. There are also 3 television versions, one from 1960 that aired on the Shirley Temple show, which featured, Shirley Temple herself. And playing Barnaby, Jonathan Winters. And then in 1986, there was a TV movie directed by Clive Donner, starring Drew Barrymore, Richard Mulligan, Keanu Reeves, Eileen Brennan, and Pat Morita as the toy maker, which actually cut most of the original score, apart from one or two songs, in order to replace it with a new score by Leslie Bricusse, who you might know for doing the songs for Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Victor Victoria, and Tom and Jerry the Movie.
Yeah.
Currently, the last film adaptation of Babes in Toyland was released in 1997, direct-to-video, an animated film directed by Toby Bluth, who is Don Bluth's brother, Charles Grosvenor, and Paul Sabella, and featuring a cast that includes Jim Belushi, Bronson Pinchot, Charles Nelson Reilly, and Christopher Plummer.
Nice.
But as we said earlier, we're discussing the Disney 1961 version, and as we mentioned before, this is the first ever live-action musical from Disney. Now, it wasn't always planned this way. Back when this film was initially being floated in, like, the 1950s, this was going to be an animated film, which was produced by Bill Shaw and directed by Sidney Miller, and would have released after Sleeping Beauty had released, but then, you know, Sleeping Beauty kept getting delayed.
Yeah.
So that meant animated Babes in Toyland kept getting delayed. And then, meanwhile, Walt was waffling between doing a live-action animation, live-action-animation hybrid, because, you know, starting with, like, the 1950s, Walt was really beginning to get into live-action filmmaking, and the most prestigious of the film at the time, at least one of the most prestigious, was the movie musical. And, you know, the live-action movie musical, and Walt wanted to get in on that.
And so their first break was this.
Well, almost. So initially, Walt's first attempt at a live-action movie musical, he was going to do an Oz movie. Rainbow Road to Oz, which would have starred several of the Mouseketeers, including Darlene Galepsia as Darcy, Annette Funicello as Ozma, Bobby Burgess as a Scarecrow, and Doreen Tracy as a Patchwork Girl, along with longtime Disney star Tommy Kirk as the evil son of the Wicked Witch of the West. But it got canned for two reasons. The first, that nobody could come up with a good enough script. And the second is that the MGM film was getting really popular in TV reruns again. So Walt worried that his own attempt at an Oz film would fall short in comparison.
Yeah.
So after, you know, Rainbow Road to Oz hits the skids, he decides to go ahead and make Babes in Toyland. So he gets a man named Ward Kimball involved. Now,
one of the nine old men.
And also probably the vainiest of the nine old men in terms of like his animation style. Most prone to getting into disagreements with Walt.
Yeah.
Back in, like, the golden age of Disney, you know, with, like, Snow White, Pinocchio, and the like, he worked as a supervising animator on these such films. For instance, he was the supervising animator for Jiminy Cricket Pinocchio, which apparently he described as a pain in the ass because of Jiminy Cricket's, like, oval face.
Interesting. He also did a lot of the mice from Cinderella.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, he did.
That's really cool. He also directed the two Adventures in Music shorts, Melody and the Academy Award-winning Toot, Whistle, Plunk, and Boom, as well as several episodes of the Disneyland Anthology series, the three being Man in Space, Man on the Moon, and Mars and Beyond.
But sadly, Ward Kimball did not stay on this project forever.
Yeah, no. So, to put it from Ward Kimball himself, as he put it, about 1958 or 59, Walt called me up to his office and explained he had the rights to Babes in Toyland. Walt wanted to know if I'd like to take a crack at it, because it would go into the public domain in 1960. There had already been two or three attempts at the Disney studio to write some sort of story, but Walt figured that maybe I would have a different angle on it. I never agreed with the original Victor Herbert plot structure, because the relationships and the characters seemed confusing. I forgot about what had been done before, and worked up a plot where there was no doubt about what Barnaby was up to. Also, another reason that Walt hired Ward Kimball, besides, you know, making these two very good short films and being like a reliable presence of the company for years, is that Ward Kimball had a collection of antique toys and hoped that would serve him as inspiration. But unfortunately, Ward Kimball wouldn't direct the film for long.
Yeah.
And it all comes down to, well, two reasons, but the primary one is its cast. Now, Ward Kimball, when he was directing, he wanted to cast like contemporary comedians in the major parts. For instance, for the role of Barnaby, he wanted Louis Nye, who, if at the time, was best known for his appearances on the Steve Allen Show. For the Toymaker, he wanted comedian Sid Caesar, who at the time had his own sketch comedy show, Your Show of Shows. He wanted to have the soon-to-be creator of the Dick Van Dyke Show, Carl Reiner, as Rodrigo. Now, Walt, he did not want contemporary comedians in his movies. This was supposed to be like his first attempt at like a Hollywood musical, his own Wizard of Oz. So he wanted it to be classy. He wanted like Hollywood legends. What Ward Kimball didn't want Walt wanted and what Ward Kimball wanted, Walt didn't want. But what really sealed the deal for Ward being not thrown off the project, but removed from the director position, is that while Walt Disney was on a cruise to Europe, big ads were placed in Variety and The Hollywood Reporter congratulating Ward Kimball for getting the job as director on Disney's Babes in Toyland. Mm-hmm. Now, this was not placed there by Ward Kimball or a publicist that he hired, but by a Disney studio attorney whom, you see, at the time, Babes in Toyland, the original operetta, mm-hmm. was about to enter the public domain, which meant then it would be like open season
yes.
for any adaptation to come along. This was 1960.
Yeah.
So this lone Disney, this wasn't like a whole team of attorneys. This was just one attorney, this one lone attorney. Wolf attorney.
Single attorney.
Decides without talking to anyone or asking for approval from Walt mm-hmm. or anything like that, decides to stake Disney's claim in and tell other studios to back off by placing this message in Variety. Mm-hmm. So it's no surprise that this attorney gets fired.
Yes.
And Walt is so peeved off, mm-hmm. even though this wasn't Ward's fault, that that combined with like the disagreements with casting lead to Ward Kimball getting removed from the project. Now, he would still work on the film. He directed mm-hmm. the stop motion soldier battle sequence that mm-hmm. we'll discuss later on. But for the most part, he was, you know, kicked off.
And he was replaced with Jack Donahue.
Yes, Jack Donahue, who had been a choreographer for five Shirley Temple films mm-hmm. and several MGM musicals, choreographed Broadway shows like Top Banana and Mr. Wonderful, and directed a couple films too, like Close Up, Watch the Birdie, and then mm-hmm. several TV spectaculars for Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin, which, you know, it's not a bad resume, but
yeah.
At the same time, Jack Donahue was mainly hired because, you know, he was a solid workman director
yep.
who would not say no to Walt. And yeah.
So the cast?
Yeah, let's get into this. So with, you know, Jack Donahue more willing to play ball mm-hmm. with Mr. Disney, the cast is exactly what Walt wants it to be. So
it's exactly what Walt wants it to be, plus some people who have also worked on previous Disney projects.
Yeah, which I think Disney wanted too. He like wanted yes. like old Hollywood legends and like certain parts. And then like the fresh young Disney faces to bring in the kids.
Yes.
Which is actually Ward Kimball's logic with yes. bringing in contemporary comedians. But, you know.
But Walt wanted to do it with previous Disney stars.
Yes. Guys and gals who are already yes. under contract. So who Walt Disney wanted mm-hmm. for Barnaby over Louie and I was Ray Bolger. Or Ray Bolger?
Ray Bolger. And he was the Scarecrow from Wizard of Oz, is what he's most known for.
Yeah, that is his most famous role. This was his first appearance in a film in like 8 years. He had previously been only really making like television appearances. Like he had his own sitcom, Where's Raymond? Mm-hmm. Later retitled The Ray Bolger Show, which lasted from 1953 to 55. So not only was it his first film mm-hmm. in like 8 years, it was also his first villain role.
Yeah, he did a great job.
Yeah, I'd say so.
And they needed someone to dance. And if you've seen The Wizard of Oz, you know that this man can dance. And
he can still dance really well, even though yeah. it only gets like one real big dance number sequence.
Yes.
So, and he gets top billing, mm-hmm. you know, it's probably like the biggest Hollywood legend of the bunch. Playing the two leads, you know, the symmetrical faced romantic leads mm-hmm. are Annette Funicello as Mary.
She was in the Mickey Mouse Club.
Yeah, one of the original Mouseketeers and yeah. easily the most popular of the Mouseketeers.
She was 12 at that time.
She was really?
She was a child actor.
Yeah. You know, but she quickly gains popularity and prominence. Mm-hmm. Walt pushes her into a recording career, mm-hmm. despite Annette's reluctance to be a singer.
Yeah.
But she easily becomes, like, the most popular of the Mouseketeers, both for, you know, because she's a charming lady.
She set the precedent for following Disney Channel stars.
Yeah, so, but you know, you can see why she became so popular. She's yeah. got a natural screen presence. Mm-hmm. She's very charming, very likable.
Yeah.
She later gets into a contract with Disney, does a bunch of other stuff. Mm-hmm. She, this was her second theatrical film for the Disney company. and her last before moving on to do the American International Pictures mm-hmm. Beach Party movies. Though she did do the two Merlin Jones movies, like, at the same time as she did the Beach Party movies. Appeared in a couple Mickey Mouse Club serials, Spin and Marty, its follow-up serial, and her own serial series, Annette, where she plays a orphan country girl who goes to, like, the upper middle-class suburban area to live with her aunt and uncle. And she also has guest appearances on two different storylines on the Disney Zorro series. It's worth noting that Annette Funicello wasn't, like, considered, like, right away for Mary. Pretty much the assistant to the producer, Lou Debney, essentially went up to Walt and was like, hey, you know, if Columbia or Universal were making this, they'd come to us and say, hey, can we borrow Annette?
Yeah. So they decided to use her as the role.
Yes. So playing the male lead, Tom, is...
Tommy Sands,
who was a teen idol who hit it big when he appeared on an episode of Kraft Television Theater entitled The Singing Idol.
He actually got onto that show with the encouragement of Elvis, of all people. Elvis Presley was one of his big fans and basically told the show runners, hey, put him on this. They did.
Yeah. He was under a contract with Colonel Tom Parker, mm-hmm. same guy who did manage Elvis. So that does make sense in hindsight.
Tommy Sands was very known as a teen heartthrob and had a hit song called Teenage Crush, which is the most, like, teenage heartthrob title of a song you can get.
That actually debuted in that episode mm-hmm. of Kraft Television Theater yeah. that he was in. So the episode The Singing Idol is about Tommy Sands plays a teen idol.
Wow, singer, as you do.
Who, after his father, who is a preacher, dies, mm-hmm. Considers the fulfilling his father's dying wish of giving up the music business and returning home to become a small-town preacher. Mm. Even though he was known for singing, he was also trained as an actor and eventually decided to largely forego singing in order to focus on films. Mm-hmm. He didn't really go much of anywhere with this. Mm-hmm. I mean, he made a few films, but eventually, like, fell off. According to Tommy Sands himself, he wasn't the only one in consideration for the part.
Yeah, there were a few other big names, weren't there?
Yeah, there was James Darren, who at the time was best known for the role of Moondoggy mm-hmm. in Gidget and its sequel, Gidget Goes Hawaiian. And then also Michael Callan, who played Riff in the original Broadway production of West Side Story. Mm. Those two are cast, and they play the leads, and...
They play the leads Tom and Mary, which in the original were siblings, but now here are the love interests, because now there's not that whole
Al and Jane are cut entirely, and that was, like, one of Ward Kimball's doings. He wanted to make the storyline, like, concise and clear.
Yeah, there's no convoluted family crossover love interest things.
Another thing that Ward Kimball did is that he had the original Victor Herbert and Glenn McDonough songs rewritten and with new lyrics, and that was done. The rearranging was done by George Bruns, and the new lyrics were done by Mel Levin. Only the March of the Toys was left unaltered, and that was, like, used during the Toy Soldier sequence. And one new song was written outright, entitled Slowly He Sank to the Bottom of the Sea. So
these were largely modernized versions of these songs. Like,
sometimes they sound very similar to the original operetta, and sometimes they do not. Like, I think one of the most blatant of this is Castle in Spain, which yes. in the original is a, like, romantic song sung by Tom Tom to Jane. The Disney adaptation, it makes it a villain love song.
Yeah, the Barnaby sings.
There was, like, a bouncier beat and, like, a slightly quicker energy.
Yeah.
And more humorous lyrics. And
a nice little slapsticky dance.
Yes, a great slapsticky dance. Yeah. That musical number is easily like the highlight of the entire film for me.
In our castle in Spain, you'll be living rent-free. Every capital gain you'll share with me. From this village below, every cent we will drain, and our fortune will grow in our castle in Spain.
And like, the difference is very clear once you give it a listen. Both of them, George Bruns and Mel Levin, had histories with the Disney company. George Bruns co-wrote The Ballad of Davy Crockett for the Disney Davy Crockett series, and Yo-Ho, A Pirate's Life for Me for Pirates of the Caribbean, and also did the scores for Sleeping Beauty, which he won an Academy Award for, and 101 Dalmatians. Mel Levin, meanwhile, you remember this song? Ba-dum, ba-dum,
ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. You did Cruella de Vil in 101 Dalmatians.
Yes. So, a little digression there. Let's get back to the cast. So, playing the role of the toy maker is
Edwin.
Edwin, whom nowadays you probably know mainly as like the Mad Hatter.
Yeah.
And to a lesser extent, Uncle Albert and Mary Poppins.
He looks like the Mad Hatter in this movie.
Yes. But he's actually had like a very interesting career. He started out as like a vaudeville performer in the early 1900s, around the time when the original operetta was coming out in the Ziegfeld Follies, where he was very much known for his like hamming and his clowning and his mugging. In fact, his mugging was so extensive that at one point he pissed off W.C. Fields that W.C. Fields knocked him out with a pool cue.
Oh my God.
And he's known- he later gets on a contract with the Schubert brothers, a leader of the Schubert organization that owns all those theaters in New York. But when he takes part in a nationwide actors' strike, the strike that leads to the recognizing of the Actors' Equity Union, he's blacklisted from Schubert theaters and his Schubert contract is canceled. Wow. So what does he do? He starts producing, writing, and staging his own shows that are actually pretty well, doing pretty well for the most part. Well, somewhat. They get harder and harder to perform well when the Great Depression rolls around, unfortunately. So in the 1930s, he goes on to do radio shows. He does a show called The Fire Chief, which was sponsored by Texaco to promote their emergency-grade gasoline, which is hilariously irresponsible for a corporation.
Yes.
But the way he does his radio, because he's so afraid that his shtick wouldn't carry over on the radio, he actually did the shows on stage in front of a live audience. Those would be recorded and aired over the radio. So, and he doesn't like write any differently for radio either. Like, he still writes them as stage shows, but it actually is very popular.
Yeah.
But then things start to go off the rails from in 1933. He starts his own radio network with a Hungarian violinist named Oda Gigi, known as the Amalgamated Broadcast System, which, for various reasons, was a financial disaster that destroyed Edwin's life savings and put him in extreme depression. Then in that interim, he voices the Mad Hatter for Alice in Wonderland.
Yes.
Because Walt was a huge fan. And he tries some other stuff for a while. He has his own variety show that won an Emmy and a Peabody, but was canceled after one season due to low ratings. And he's considering like retiring entirely. But his son, Keenan Wynn, he encourages him, hey, maybe give some dramatic acting a try. So he starts off with a Rod Serling-written episode of the TV show Playhouse 90 entitled Requiem for a Heavyweight. He gets a ton of critical praise. It's sort of a big comeback for him. He does more dramatic parts, culminating in him getting nominated for Best Supporting Actor at the 1959 Academy Awards for his role in The Diary of Anne Frank. So now Walt definitely wants to be a big part of the Edwin comeback, so he casts Edwin as the toy maker. Edwin himself put it, "It was Walt's challenge to recapture something we laughed at 30 years ago that intrigued me. That something is a combination of the dramatic together with parts of the Perfect Fool and the Fire Chief characters I played on stage and radio that long ago." Joining him, Edwin, as part of a sort of comedy team, is Tommy Kirk,
who plays his assistant Grumio.
there's a lot that we can say about Tommy Kirk that we're probably going to save it for later down the line, like when we talk about films that he actually like starred in, like the Merlin Jones films.
We'll keep it short for now.
Yeah, okay. But the point is that he had been in several Disney productions, the Hardy Boy serials, mm-hmm, for Mickey Mouse Club, Old Yeller, Shaggy Dog, Swiss Family Robinson, Absent Mind Professor. And around this time, he was on a long-term contract, mm-hmm, with the Disney company. And along with Annette and Tommy Kirk, there were two other alumnus, mm-hmm, of Disney television that were in this movie. Henry Calvin and Gene Sheldon as Barnaby's henchmen, Gunzer, yeah, Zorgo, and Rodrigo, who both were on the Disney Zorro series. Henry, yeah, Calvin played Sergeant Demetrio Lopez Garcia, and Gene Sheldon played Bernardo, Zorro's right-man hand and sidekick.
Nice.
Walt apparently was considering making many films with Calvin and Sheldon as like a comedy team together, but those unfortunately never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the last but not least of our cast, mm-hmm, is Mary McCarty's mother, Goose, who, mm-hmm, was a consistent Broadway presence prior and after this movie. But what most interested me about her is that she was the originator of Matron Mama Morton, really? In the musical Chicago.
Really?
Yes. So that's, you see, amazing, this like gentle Mother Goose lady, and then imagine her singing, "So boost me up, my ladder kid, and I'll boost you up yours."
So that's our main cast.
That is our main cast.
So also someone who worked on this movie was Xavier Atencio, who wrote the songs for the Pirates and the Haunted Mansion rides. And he actually helped design some of the toy soldiers in the later scene of the March of the Toy Soldiers.
Along with Bill Justice, working, mm-hmm, under Ward Kimball, who was directing that sequence.
So Xavier's soldiers are marked with an X for his name because he was known as X.
Atencio. Yeah. That's what he's commonly referred to as.
Yeah. So the movie,
yes,
itself.
Let's talk about the movie itself.
The film opens with a goose, and it's a puppet. And
Sylvester J. Goose.
Yes.
Also known as Silly Goose, which right off the bat, fuck you.
So it's so he's just a puppet who is literally Mother Goose's arm, and then like she comes out and he's just like kind of hanging off there, and it's,
and she's got like a fake arm that's made to look like she's holding him, but it's a blatantly cheap effect,
yeah,
not held by the stiffness of the puppet.
And yes, it's a very,
and also
weird,
his eyes
puppet
blink independently, yeah, which I believe is done by like a radio operator, but the, yeah, effect is very creepy.
Yes.
Not helped by like his like dignified adult voice,
yeah,
which is done by the film's director, Jack Donahue.
Yeah. So we open with her introducing us to the world, and the stage open, the curtains open, and the stage is set.
The big sat down stage, and
there's a it's a beautiful set design. There's like cartoony, fantasy-esque things everywhere. It's very colorful and candy.
It really ties in with this whole film's aesthetic.
Yes.
As like a live action cartoon.
Yes.
But that virtue is also a problem because it means you don't take anything seriously in,
yeah,
the verisimilitude. The film very much feels like a 1930s musical.
Yeah.
That has inexplicably been made in the 1960s.
It's 30 years too late.
Like, we talked about Walt's casting choices. That definitely carries, mm-hmm, into it. And also just the general like look and
the entire
feel of it,
which is very, very whimsical. So it opens with like a dance sequence that's very well choreographed and very like well costumed and very nice and stuff like that. But that kind of big set choreography is lost over the course of the film. Like, it just disappears entirely about halfway through.
Yeah.
And
all these cartoony flourishes, like the growing candle.
Yeah.
And like the guy dancing with a whole bunch of pies bouncing.
Yeah.
And like those chorus girls holding,
yeah,
like lemonade.
Lemonade. Drink the lemonade.
Yeah.
Drink the Kool-Aid, Tom and Mary.
Drink the lemonade to honor the wedding.
Yeah.
Because weddings are, lemonade is a common wedding drink, I guess.
Like I said, drink the Kool-Aid, join our cartoon.
Yeah.
And so they're getting married, Tom and Mary. And it's,
remember, in the original operetta, our brother and sister. That'll never not amuse me.
I think the effects in this, as cheesy as they are very like well done. I think they're very sweet.
And I think cute. It works. A lot of the time yeah. it's very obvious, but it still looks impressive because it like ties in with that whole yeah, cartoony aesthetic.
It feels like a cartoon.
I think the only effects that are like an outright failure mm-hmm. are Sylvester J. Goose, as we mentioned yes. earlier, and the walking talking trees that are featured like later on in the movie.
The walking talking trees, their faces are pretty cool because like their faces move and like the people inside can move them, but like they don't have any movable limbs and they just like have to walk in these really tight tree costumes. So like you watch these people like waddling around and like the only thing that's moving on them is the face.
There actually was a Babes in Toyland walkthrough attraction
yes.
at Disneyland in the early 1960s at the Main Street Opera House
yeah.
before Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln came
in. It lasted 2 years.
They did have like walking talking trees and apparently they would very commonly scare guests.
Yeah,
so maybe
they're terrifying.
Just desensitized.
They're terrifying to look at.
I thought they were kind of goofy, actually.
We have Tom and Mary, the most, like, milquetoast couple. They have good enough chemistry, I guess, when they're dancing.
Kind of, sort of.
When they're dancing, they have great chemistry. And then they have a song together later on. And, like, I don't believe either of them. I don't believe either of them wants to be there.
I think Annette Funicello comes off looking worse in this than Tommy Sands because
yeah.
Tommy Sands does have like the occasional moment where he gets like a bit of fun to do, but Annette, she just has nothing to work with here.
She kind of looks blankly at everything and
you see Annette, her common character type is like, she was the every girl. She was the girl next door.
Yeah.
Now here she has to be the romantic heroine, or I guess ingenue is the right word for it. And that's like what seems like a slight difference, but also makes like all the difference. It does not fit her at all.
Yeah. For most of the movie, she kind of sits around and things happen around her, it seems.
Also, it's readily apparent that even though they rearranged the songs, those songs were not originally written for someone of her vocal abilities.
Yeah.
Like, they were written for, like, you know, an actual opera performer.
Yes.
And, you know, that's another problem with the movie. It's an operetta that they have reshaped to fit the conventions of the musical. And even though there's, like, and even though the operetta is like a precursor to the musical, it the slight change makes all the difference.
As Time Magazine put it, the creators should have restricted the impulse to modernize Victor Herbert's music. They might as well try to jazz up Piers Porter Goldtropin with Pepsi Cola.
What was that?
It's a fancy wine.
You see, I'm not like a wine connoisseur.
Well, that's, yeah.
For two people doing a podcast revolving around facts and history, uh-huh. we are quite dumb.
Yeah, I don't know shit. So, yeah, we have our milquetoast protagonist, and we have our exciting Mr. Barnaby.
Yeah, he's our main villain, Barnaby.
He's dressed up like a knockoff Vincent Price.
I think he's more like a snidely whiplash old-time vaudeville.
Yeah,
he's got the mustache and like the black cape and the black suit.
Yeah,
and
he looks great in the purple.
Yeah, and I forgot that like the inside of the cape is purple. That is, and he's got like this big creepy house on a hill, and he looks down at them with like a crooked telescope.
One of my favorite parts of this movie, genuinely, is he has a recurring gag where he talks to his henchmen and he'll be like, come on, let us, and then blank. And he goes, come on, let us plot. And then they'll like rub their hands together and they'll like hide behind something and go scheme. Or they'll be like, come, let us pussyfoot. And then like they walk in a circle and they walk off stage. And I'm like, it's very funny.
So then as in the original operetta, Barnaby, you know, he tells Gonzorgo and Rodrigo, hey, I'll pay you money if you drown this guy for me.
They don't drown him.
No, this is where things get dicey, because arguably even worse than the original operetta, this movie is crazy racist towards Romani.
Yes. So,
and by the way, we mentioned in our Disney Plus episode that, like, for like films that are like considered hashtag problematic, that they've got like, you know, content warnings hidden.
This one has none.
This one has none.
I was very surprised that this one has none. But basically what happens is he's sold to...
So Gonzalo and Rodrigo, they decide they want to get double the money for their kidnapping.
So instead of killing him, they sell him to a group of Romani travelers.
But they don't refer to them as Romani. They refer to them as the Gisler. You hear the Gisler a lot in this movie.
Yeah. It doesn't go away.
And it gets way more uncomfortable later on, which...
Yeah.
Oh boy. And then also part of his plan is to steal Mary's sheep because she's financially dependent on sheep. Does she like shear them? Does she?
I don't know, but she also doesn't know how to count, apparently.
Yes, there's a whole... That's another thing. Okay, so...
So we got into the racism. Shall we get into the sexism?
Yeah, okay. So part of Barnaby's plan is to take away Mary's livelihood so that she'll have to marry him in order to... get her inheritance, because the reason he wants to marry Mary is because when she marries, she will get an inheritance. From who? Never says.
No.
Why, when she gets married, never says. Which, honestly, isn't that glaring a flaw, because the whole film runs on cartoon logic, so you're not really thinking about that. So he also has Gonzorgo and Rodrigo kidnap Mary's sheep and set them loose in the forest of no return.
A bunch of children go after those sheep and almost get killed by some trees, but we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
So she's left, like, financially, like...
You know, no man, no sheep. She's got to, like, handle the depths of the debt of her home where she takes care of all her orphan children.
She sings a song called I Can't Do the Sum, in which there are multiple, like, rainbow-colored versions of her dancing around, some of them standing on their head, etc. And the entire song is her basically going, I don't know how to do math because I'm a woman.
Picture us inside a tent, beastly poor, insecure. We must save the 6%. 6 times X, how complex. Numbers always stick our brain. Why are we so dumb? This is much too hard for us. We can't do the sum.
Yeah.
It's very...
it ties in with... the thing with the original operetta with Babes in Toyland is that a lot of the songs are not really there to advance the plot.
No.
They're just there as, like, digressions.
Yeah. And it's supposed to be cutesy and fun.
Yeah,
but...
I Can't Do the Sum is one of them. That was not there to advance the plot. It's just, like, a bunch of, like, goofy lyrics.
If Clarence took Fair Gwendolyn out for an auto ride, and if at 60 miles an hour one kiss to capture tried, and quite forgot the steering gear on her honeyed lips to suck, how soon could 20 men with brooms sweep Claire and Gwynny up?
This sounds just like my high school algebra test.
But so, you know, it's like it's just a goofy like thing of math stuff that tell humorous anecdotes.
But the thing about it is, like we mentioned, this the movie feels very outdated, and so does some of the sentiments of the song of "Oh, I'm financially dependent on my husband," and it's like, yeah, it's.
I mean, one could argue that it's more about like her failure to make ends meet in any way, but you know. It still sounds like girls can't do math.
Well, the rest of this movie doesn't do well to help the case otherwise at all, considering Tom at one point refers to her as his toy.
Oh, yes.
And his doll.
Oh, God.
And, like, it's very...
I forgot about that until you reminded me.
Yeah, no, it's very outdated.
Yeah. I mean, product of its time, I guess.
It's but even for its time, it seemed outdated. Like, it was the 60s.
Yeah, accurate. But I guess Disney's always been, like, one decade behind the rest of the decade.
So, yeah. But apparently Annette really loved doing this song. She got to stand on her head, and she was very excited about that.
It's nice.
Yeah.
I like Annette.
So good for her. Tom's not dead. And comes back in a big musical number.
Yeah, Barnaby invites the Camp of Romanis to do a performance to celebrate his and Mary's engagement. And I guess they only like bought Tom just to like, you know, set him loose and get revenge. They never really explained, because any Romani in this film are, well, A, played by white people.
Yeah.
And B, only there to serve as like background dancers for the Floretta number. And mind you, the plot point of like someone being disguised as a Romani person is also present in the operetta.
Yeah.
But somehow this movie does it much worse.
Yeah.
Like in terms of racism, far, far worse than the opera written at the literal turn of the century. Like, for instance, here is a sampling of lyrics. Oh, and we should mention that Tom's disguise, he's disguised himself as a, you know, referring for himself, a G-word fortune teller. And this disguise involves, you know, like a rag cloak, like a wig of white hair, and most egregiously, a like fake prosthetic jutting chin, and a fake hook nose.
Yeah.
Which, holy shit.
Yeah. It's really bad.
Am I actually watching this, is what I was thinking.
Yeah, I remember watching this and being like, this is painful.
For what it's worth, I think I did warn you in advance.
Oh yeah.
But it was
still painful.
I was thrown for a loop. So here are some lyrics of the number, in case you want to be just as horrified as we. Ahem. A wandering vagrant am I, a product of sheriff's evictions. A G-slur by birth, I have roamed half the earth, telling fortunes and telling predictions. My skill is a magical art. I'm not just a usual swami. I don't entertain with a fake ledger mane, and my breath doesn't reek of salami.
This not only, like, presents it, but it like milks it. It's really bad.
Yeah, like Tommy Sands goes like full ham with this.
Yeah, it's really bad.
Honestly, it's one of the few times in the musical where he like really lets loose.
And, but
like,
not in a good way.
Yeah, like he seems like he's having fun, but at the same time.
But what is he having fun with?
Stop having fun, Tommy Sands. What's the matter with? I almost would prefer you to be boring in this movie.
He's boring when he's every other time. So he's not dead.
Yeah, Tom reveals his disguise.
He's not dead, but he's racist.
But you know, is Tom truly the better choice? Amanda, I think you had a question raised.
So I think my main question of this movie, in regards to our villain, our brilliant dancer, our got a great musical number, is Barnaby fuckable? So I think we should go through the list of pros and cons here.
Yeah, she made a fucking pros and cons list on whether or not one should fuck Barnaby.
Okay.
Or Ray Bolger playing.
Okay,
villain.
This is just for the general public, and it's for you to find out. But like, I looked at this character and I was like, I feel like someone's horny for him. It's not me. I don't know if it's you, but there's someone out there.
I could see the appeal, but I don't think he'd exactly be my type.
So, is Mr. Barnaby fuckable? Pro. Money.
Yay!
He's got a really cool house. He's offering it to Mary.
That house kind of sucked. It looked very cramped from what I saw of it.
But the outside was cool.
Yeah, I guess if you got like an interior decorator or something.
And well, once he stole all her money, it would have been fine.
Yeah.
So
and he got all the rest of his money, like taxing and hiking up the rent for the other citizens.
So
he's got money.
That's a con. He's manipulative and will try to steal your money. Pro. Looks good in black suit and purple. Con. May kill your loved ones.
I don't have many loved ones anyway.
Pro. Has people hired that will do what he wants, and maybe for you. Cons. Uses racial slurs.
I mean, so does everyone else in the movie.
Yeah, so is he all that different? Con, Vincent Price knockoff. Pro, Vincent Price knockoff.
So what are you saying, that he about breaks even?
That's not for me to decide.
That's for you to decide. Tell us on Twitter, is Barnaby fuckable? We genuinely want that answer. We know there are some listeners who will definitely have an answer to that question. Yes. Yeah, as we said, Tom and Mary reunite.
Yes.
Happy together. Barnaby loses, movie over. Oh, wait. Those kids went to the Forest of No Return to get the sheep. And now they're trapped by...
They're harassed by a bunch of trees who say this is our forest. So you have to report to our boss because you're not supposed to be here.
Yeah, they tell them, hey, this is our woods. You can no longer leave.
So I thought...
It's like that episode of Aqua Teen Hunger Force.
Revenge of the Trees!
Yes!
Oh my god, that's what it reminded me of. I really thought that they were going to, like, pick up these kids and, like, threaten to skin them alive or something like that, you know, like they did with Carl.
Use the human flesh paper!
Oh my god! Shake must pay for his crimes.
As you can see from the wooden video.
Wow. We're on the same page.
Hey, listen, I am respectful of my Earth Mother. Now let's tip.
So
go back to your mini balls.
So yeah, the trees are like, they don't hold their own court. They are under the rule of the toy maker, who is the like ruler of this land. I think he owns the original
Toyland of a king, but he was just the king's favorite underling.
So here he is, like...
He's a good guy, first off. Well, he's not evil.
So they go to the Toymaker, and it's Edwin. Lovable Edwin. He's very great in this movie. He looks like the Mad Hatter in this movie. His hair is kind of everywhere, and he's got, like, a cute little hat. And
yeah, Edwin always brings it.
Yeah, and... This was the first time I've experienced, like, actual joy in this movie. Like, there's some good moments, but this was the first time that I was like, yay, I'm excited to be watching this. But he's the toy maker. He's unimpressed by everything that his assistant brings him.
His assistant, played by my personal highlight. Your personal highlight seemed to be either Barnaby or Tommy.
Edwin.
Edwin. My personal highlight is... I thought that Edwin was just doing what was expected of him. What really surprised me and how great he was Tommy Kirk as the assistant. Because, he is such an adorable Muppet. Mm-hmm. And B, is fucking hysterical. He just got this, like, wild, nervous, like, manic energy to him. And we're just showing all this enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's largely gonna, like, play the foil to Edwin, but he just... plays the foil so well that I feel like he outshines Edwin a bit.
I really like Edwin in this. I think it's because of his character. Because his character is a fucking asshole. So basically, every time Grumio brings like something to his attention, like, oh, look, sir, I have a new invention. He's like, bitch, no, you haven't. It's mine now. And we'll start fucking around with it, basically.
And fuck it up.
So basically,
well, the second one... Tommy Kirk generally talking through. First one, you know, his invention was genuinely brilliant. Then the toy maker fucks it up.
So the first invention is the toy machine, which, like, it's very cute. They, like, it's, like, a big thing. And this thing, like, on set was big. It took 28 Disney stage electricians to control this from a panel of 400 switches.
Jesus Christ.
This was a mess. Disney was like, man, I wish I had one of these in real life. But it made toys, basically. It was like a supercomputer.
Yeah, mass-producing toys.
But it didn't, like, mass-produce toys to the way that the toy maker wanted, and he put too many in and he broke it. And then
he, like, Grumio, that was a terrible idea. You suck.
And, yeah, he's an asshole. I feel
bad for Tommy Kirk. He's doing... He genuinely has good ideas.
Listen. Grumio should, like, go out, like, take that idea, patent it, and eventually, like, the Toymaker's going to be out of business. He's going to be out of a job. He's like, wow, look at this, like, computer. Like, wow. And I'm like, bro, wait 2 years, you're going to be out of a job. The computers will replace you.
Here's another thing. Should Tommy Kirk have been... the lead instead of Tommy Sands?
I think so.
Yeah, I think he is far more charismatic as an actor.
Yeah.
And granted, this is the only thing I've seen Tommy Vance in. Maybe he's better with like a better script.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of like character wise, I would much rather like he's like a classic underdog mm-hmm. hero and like you know the Disney tradition. You know, he's scrappy. He's like has big dreams.
Yeah.
You know, he'd be the perfect male lead. And plus, you know, he does have a chemistry with Annette Funicello. They've done several movies together. They, or at least will do. They, you know, the Merlin Jones
yeah.
movies. One of the Beach Party movies, Pajama Party,
mm-hmm.
in which he plays a Martian who comes to Earth to prep for an invasion and then falls in love with Annette.
Nice. So, yeah. Yeah, he's great.
He is great. He runs away with this movie.
Yeah.
In my opinion, and it's a shame that he's in it for so little. He just like,
oh, yeah.
Like three individual scenes where he shows off like different inventions. So like,
and each time he's
one is just there to advance the plot.
He's put down. The toy maker says, oh, that's a stupid invention. He uses the invention. Then the toy maker's like, wow, look at this invention. It's mine now. Takes it, fucks things up. And then after things are fucked up, he goes, you did terribly, Grumio. It's your fault. And then...
Well, I think the second one, Grumio genuinely didn't think the thing through. The second one is
yeah.
like a shrinking machine to shrink big things down to little things. And then Tommy Sands asks, so where exactly are you going to get the big things?
After the toy machine blows up, Ed Wynn looks at Grumio and says, go on. Go to your room and invent something to destroy yourself. Imagine Edwin looking at you and telling you to go kill yourself in that voice. Yeah.
He would be the... I'm not sure if Edwin himself or Edwin's toy maker would be the worst suicide hotline operator ever.
Yeah. God. His character is such an asshole in this. And he's just like...
It wouldn't be surprising if this guy was trying to get evil spirits to possess toys.
Yeah, it's a very weird, it's also a very weird diversion from the rest of the movie, which felt pretty coherent. And now suddenly we're in Toy Factory and it feels like a completely different movie suddenly.
You think?
I think so. For me, it feels like two plots mushed into one.
Hmm.
Because it's an hour and 12 minutes in when we first mentioned the word Christmas. That's right, gang. This is a Christmas movie. Did you forget? I did. Edwin flaunts his power. It's terrifying. And
Edwin must be stopped. Sic Semper Tyrannis.
He is like this authoritarian like ruler of Toyland.
Yeah, and then, you know, all of his toys are destroyed in like the machine explosion.
Mm-hmm.
So Tom and Mary and these children, he's all too happy to accept child labor.
Oh, he goes, nobody wants to work these days. And then he hires a bunch of kids.
Ed Wynn is a capitalist.
Yes.
He is Jeff Bezos.
Yes.
The toy maker is Elon Musk.
Oh my God.
And Grumio is everyone who actually does the inventing for Elon Musk.
Yeah. So they make toys and then Grumio comes in with like a shrink ray.
Yeah, to make big things into little things to make toys.
The toy maker thinks it's genius because he's like, wow, I can make toys now out of anything, and they're like, well, where are you going to get the big things to make toys? And then he goes, this is a terrible invention.
I mean, granted, Grumio generally didn't think things through that time, but
yeah,
doesn't make it terrible. There's still plenty of practical applications, I suppose.
So he gets shrunk.
So Barnaby Gorgo and Rodrigo sneak in to decide, hey, let's shrink Tom and get rid of him. So then that way, Mary will marry me for sure. Which, you know, this whole plan, you still need to get married to actually agree to marry you, buddy.
Yeah.
Maybe you could have offered to, like, waive her mortgage. Or, hell, give her money to support herself. That might have endeared her to you.
Yeah.
You know, not just, like, do an elaborate dance about how you're gonna eat cake while you rip off the rest of the townspeople.
Yeah.
It was a nice dance, though. Very
it was a very nice
well
dance.
Well choreographed. Use of the fountains, especially.
Yeah. So after this point, like halfway through, we don't get any more like dance numbers or anything like that.
No.
Like there's an hour of them basically that, and like they slow down over the course of that hour. And then the second half is suddenly nothing. There's none of that. Basically, Tom gets shrunk down. Barnaby takes over. He's like, ha ha ha, you're going to marry me, Mary. And
then Zorgo and Rodrigo have a change of heart, even though Rodrigo is all too eager to slit Tom's throat at the beginning.
Yes.
So he shrinks them too. He shrinks the toy maker. And then that leads to probably the most famous sequence of this movie.
Iconic.
The stop motion toy soldier battle, yes, which as we mentioned was helmed by Ward Kimball.
Yep.
And assisted by Bill Justice and Ex Atencio.
Yeah.
So it's a very fun sequence.
It is. It's very cute. They move at on a 12 beat, which means every step is 12 frames.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks very fluid.
It's very cute. It's like it's one of the places where the movie diverges a bit to focus on the visuals, and I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's easily the strongest sequence of the bunch, and makes me wonder what the rest of the film would have been like if Ward Kimball had kept directing
it.
And those toy soldiers, they've definitely stuck around. They've been like a mainstay of the Disney Parks Christmas parade since like the 60s.
Yeah, they sell plenty of toys of those still.
Yeah, you know, they're always fun to see. I didn't even realize they were from a movie at first. I just figured they like inexplicably showed up.
That's kind of what I mean by iconic, because like you don't really associate them with anything, but then when you do, that's like the most memorable thing from this movie.
Like, hey, I like them.
Yeah, you associate it with Babes in Toyland.
Yeah, but only after you watch it.
Yes.
Otherwise, you just associate with like the Disney park.
Yeah.
And even maybe after that, I don't know.
And
so yeah, you know, big battle, you know.
Very nice.
Barnaby gets shrunk down and locked in a box and then just disappears from the movie entirely. Gromeo comes in conveniently with an invention to make small things grow.
Yeah. Wow. Would you look at that?
But of course, the toy maker doesn't learn his lesson to be like, you will make a fine toy maker. Nope. He's still an asshole.
Yeah. We love our Elon Musk, Edwin.
Edwin Musk. So Tom wins. Everyone grows back to bigger. Tom and Mary get married. It ends. Then you go home to drink away your problems, as was wont to do in the 1960s.
Yeah, this was almost a 2-hour long movie. And not very little happens in it, but it's so stretched out that I found myself struggling to get through it because of how tangential some of the sequences are.
It's both its length and also how slight it is. There's not much depth or pathos to it. Leonard Maltin wrote in his book, The Disney Films, that one could argue that Babes in Toyland taught Disney what not to do when doing Mary Poppins. Yeah, that 100% carries. Like, you definitely see, like, a rise in production values, like a focused, serious narrative, like a very more grounded reality of film in terms of, like, a live-action musical. A score that actually fits what story they're trying to tell, or at least one that's more modern to times. Stars that, you know, are actually relevant to the people of the day.
Yeah.
Like, Walt learned his lesson in like casting modern talent when he got Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins. So yeah, so essentially Mary Poppins, one could say, is Babes in Toyland done right.
Yeah.
Or Babes in Toyland, Mary Poppins done wrong.
This movie was a precursor for everything that followed in Disney live action movie musicals. It's cute. It has a lot of cute moments. It's befuddled with strange early 50s and previous sentiments of like racism and sexism and such. It's altogether kind of boring, but there are some very nice performances in there.
It's a mixed bag.
I can count everything that I really liked about it on one hand, I think.
I think it became a Disney Christmas mainstay for so long because there was just a lack of options in terms of Disney Christmas stuff. I mean, before that, you just had, like, what? A few, like, short animated shorts and, like, Mickey's Christmas Carol doesn't come out until, like, the early 1980s.
Yeah.
You know, so in terms of like, hey, what Disney film are we bringing out for Christmas or like airing on TV?
Yeah.
It was Babes in Toyland or jack shit.
Yeah. But yeah, it barely feels like a Christmas movie. I can count everything I like about it on one hand, that being one, good choreography, two, Edwin, three, Tommy Kirk, four, Barnaby, and five, the toy soldier sequence.
I'd add to that, the songs, some of them, the way they, I think Castle and Spain, the version in this movie is better than the one in the original operetta. But in terms of like, this how some of the rearrange this movie, you still definitely hear enough of the much superior versions of the original operetta. And I know I sound like such a snob.
The superior versions.
Yeah. That, you know, you're like, okay, yeah, this is still good enough for me to listen to. This is still getting stuck in my head. I still find this catchy and enjoyable. The problem with making a movie about Babes in Toyland, which, reading like the original script like I did and listening to the original score, is that Babes in Toyland just doesn't really carry itself well to filmmaking without making major changes. The script, the book is more of like very witty humor, like stuff you chuckle at more than laugh out loud, like a lot of wordplay and one-liners and the like. It's oddly dark in spots. None of the songs really are there to advance the plot.
Yeah.
It's very much, in terms of like how it's constructed, a product of its time.
Not only was the original thing very outdated, the original operetta, at this point, 60 years later.
But it was so old that it got in the public domain.
Yeah. But also, musicals themselves were changing, like theater shows, with the introduction of the Beatles into music in general, which seems like it would have nothing to do with musicals, but like once rock was in there, the theater world was completely changed.
And musical theater was getting more acerbic.
Yeah.
With like the Candor and Ebb stuff and other stuff coming down the line.
Hammerstein died the year before too.
Oh.
Yeah. And basically after the 60s were a lot of rock musicals and such.
Hair.
And yeah. So basically this came at a very unfortunate time of, it was based on something from 1903. It carried the sentiments of like, the protagonists were, felt very 50s.
Its aesthetics are very much tied with like the 1930s movie musical.
And then it came out in a time, the 60s, when musicals were in a tough spot.
It's just an odd film that came out in an odd time.
Yeah.
That it just feels very creatively compromised. Even for like a Walt era Disney movie when, you know, he was the one running the show.
Yeah. The people in it seem to enjoy being in it.
No one seems like they outright hate being there.
There's an episode of Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color called Backstage Party, in which the cast reunites and they do...
It's supposed to be like the rap party for the film.
Yeah, they perform some of the numbers from the film as well as a rewritten version that they sing to Jack Donahue. Of the, and we won't be happy till we get it, except it's, and he wasn't happy till we got it, as in like his directing and stuff like that.
Oh,
you know?
That's a bit sinister.
It was kind of cute because they were all singing it together and then they give him a Jack in the Box. And when he opens a Jack in the Box, it's his own head.
Oh, that's good.
It was really funny, actually. And they also give Edwin a Mousker, which is basically a Disney equivalent of an Oscar for 60 years of work, basically. It was very sweet. It's very charming. And there's a terrifying scene in it of all of the trees dancing. And it looks even more terrifying on this for some reason.
Does Ray Bolger do any dancing?
I believe so, yes.
That's
yeah.
good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he does. It's very nice. It looks just as good as the film, to be honest. Like, all of the performances, which is
interesting. I haven't seen it, but I feel like I'd rather watch that every Christmas.
Yeah, it's very sweet, and it feels genuine, honestly.
It feels more sincere than...
I think so, to be completely honest. It feels like a celebration of it. It feels like a celebration of something entirely boring, but this one was enjoyable and fun.
And I guess that's why I can't bring myself to, like, hate this movie despite its many flaws. Yeah. It still has that, like, very... It's kind of... Despite how, like, overproduced it is, it somehow still has, like, this weird scrappiness to it that's kind of endearing.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of charm to it. It was... It's very... I feel like, for the most part, the tone of it was a little weird as well, because I think a lot of it was geared towards little kids and stuff. And I think... A lot of older audiences maybe felt alienated by the cartoony charm of it.
But then also they like cast to appeal to the teenagers, like Tommy Sands.
They tried to appeal to teenagers, but then when you put them in like nursery rhyme land, what do you expect?
Maybe they would have been better off doing Rainbow Road to Oz. I would have loved to have seen Tommy Kirk ham it up as a villain. That would have been great fun.
Or they could have done it wonderfully animated. But yeah, so how did this movie do, Dallin?
Ah, good question.
What was the aftermath of this one?
Well, when they screened the initial rough cut of it, Walt said, you know, and I quote, "Well, I guess Disney doesn't know how to make musicals."
Oh, no. Oh, Walt.
So pretty much he brought Ward Kimball back to like recut it to get into its final shape.
Yeah.
The movie, which was made on a budget of $3 million. I don't have like the exact number of how much it made, but it was apparently a box office disappointment.
Yeah.
It did play as part of that year's Radio City Music Hall Christmas Spectacular. You know, like they would do like the stage show of the Rockettes.
Yeah.
And then the recreation of the Nativity as is tradition.
Yeah.
And then they'd also screen Babes in Toyland with that.
Yeah. Babes in Toyland has become more famous for its name, I think, than its actual content.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's really familiar with the operetta or any of the movies. Not even the Laurel and Hardy one, which is largely considered to be the best of any of those adaptations.
Not even the Disney one. I think people associate Christmas with those toy soldiers, but don't really know why. And also, the name Babes in Toyland is often used for basically anything related for with kids playing with toys.
You like, still hear the Toyland song.
Yeah. There's like hints of it in pop culture, but like they're almost untraceable in like to the general public. You know, it feels like something that's just always been there and isn't really anything that important.
Yeah.
Maybe
it's for the best, honestly. That's what this show is about. Bringing up like interesting curiosities that are lost in the past and, now, whether they're better off lost to the past, is that up for us to say?
No, but we're just going to dig them up and you have to look at them.
And if it turns out we've made a horrible mistake and have essentially unearthed the film equivalent of the Ark of the Covenant, well, sucks to be all y'all.
Yeah. And if it was Tommy Sands dressed as a Romani woman that does that for you, well, I'm sorry. Because yes, that is horrible.
It is horrible. What if was wrong with the past?
Well, I don't have enough hands with fingers to list all of the things.
Yeah, if you still want to watch this movie, it is available on Disney Plus, or you could do what I did before Disney Plus came out and went to my library.
Oh wow!
To rent it.
A library, Dallin. What is that?
It's a place where I go to rent movies and nothing else because I don't read.
What's that?
Reading. Some involving, like, there's these little marks of ink on a piece of paper. And it's supposed to make, like, something called letters. Those letters make something called words. And so on and so forth until eventually there's, like, an expression of ideas.
That's the strangest thing I've facts. Ever heard.
It's fucking stupid.
So, yeah. This movie, it makes good background noise.
Yeah.
It's cute. Put it on for your kid. I don't know.
Yeah, no, don't put it on for your kid.
Oh, don't put it on for your kid. I'm sorry.
The racism. We talked about this for like 30 minutes.
Your grandfather would really love this.
Put it on for your grandparents this Christmas as they pass out from all the turkey and Christmas cookies and the carbon monoxide you're pumping in so that you can get their inheritance.
Yeah. All you little Barnabys out there.
Yeah. Take notes.
Learn how to dance.
Yeah, you too can win over the teenage girl who's inexplicably taking care of a bunch of orphans through dancing and murder. And isn't that what this holiday season is all about?
That's what the holidays are all about.
Yeah. So I think it's about time for a send-off.
Yeah.
My name is Don Agatone.
I'm the other one.
Yeah. So long. See you in 2 weeks for our second holiday episode.
Later, fuckers. Next time on Lost in the Vault.
How far will one guy go?
Come on, Jake, you can make it.
To get home for Christmas. 3,000 miles.
I'm in the middle of nowhere being attacked by a killer buzzard.
12 states.
Put this on, act like my elf.
How the hell's that?
Happy.
One red suit.
Ho, 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 Merry Christmas.
Whatever.
For Jonathan Taylor Thomas, the holiday rush is on. Disney's I'll Be Home for Christmas.
Hey there, folks. It's us after you've just heard us.
We're back.
Do you like this show?
Me?
No, them. I guess they can't respond. Anyways, if you like this show, you know, we would be very much happy if you support it. And there are actually many ways we can do that. First off, you can visit us on our website, lost-in-the-vault.simplecast.com. Mm-hmm. You can also find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. And there you can subscribe to us and rate and review us. We would especially love it if you rate and review us because, you know, that boosts our viewing metrics. More people see us. And yeah, it would be very much appreciated if you did that. We've also have a good deal of social media presence right now. We've got a Twitter. We're at Lost Vault Cast on Twitter. We've got an Instagram. We're at Lost Vault Podcast on Instagram. We've got a Tumblr. Where you could probably just search up Lost in the Vault and you'd find us. And we've got a Letterboxd account where our username is Lost Vault Cast. Or you can email us at lostinthevaultpodcast@gmail.com. So if you've got like a question for us or you want to bring up something about the movies we've been discussing or just anything else, feel free to email us. Who knows? We might make use of it, actually.
And if you see us on the side of the road hitchhiking our way back on the outskirts of Orlando, buy us a slice of pizza.
Orlando pizza.
Orlando pizza.
Is there even any good pizza in Orlando?
I don't know. I guess we'll have to find out.
Probably just, I don't know. I feel like good pizza is more of like a city thing or, I mean, I guess Orlando's a city, but not like city.
I was just trying to make a joke of if they saw us in real life.
If they saw us in real life, they probably wouldn't even recognize us.
If you somehow recognize us in real life, hitchhiking our way back from Orlando, then pick us up. Buy us a slice of pizza. And we
maybe a hot dog.
Maybe a hot dog.
Maybe some bourbon.
Yeah. We'll appreciate anything. And subscribe. And talk to us on social media and everything.
Yeah. And yeah. We want you, the listener, to be involved.
So
that's all the ways you can get involved. So we're very happy to hear from you. We hope you come back for more and more episodes. And we'll see you next time.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye.